Hello, and welcome everyone to another Ask Me Anything Life Support ICU Decisions Tracheostomy Intensive Care at Home. My name is Patrick Hutzel, and I'm the host of this show for you. I'm doing these live streams every week, and it's a good opportunity for you to ask me anything related to you having a loved one in intensive care, or if you're looking for intensive care at home services. This is your opportunity. Now, what makes me qualified to host a show like this, where I answer all questions for families in intensive care? What makes me qualified is I'm a critical care nurse, having worked in critical care nursing for over 25 years in three different countries, where I worked as a nurse manager for over 5 years in intensive care. I've been consulting and advocating for families in intensive care for over 12 years, since 2013, as a matter of fact. And I can, here at intensivecarehotline.com, and I can very confidently say that we have saved many lives for our clients in intensive care. And you can verify that on our testimonials section at intensivecarehotline.com, and you can verify it on our intensivecarehotline.com podcast section, where we have done client interviews. I am also the founder and managing director of Intensive Care at Home, and you can find more information at intensivecareathome.com. With Intensive Care at Home, we are sending our critical care nurses into the home for long-term intensive care patients that are predominantly ventilated with a tracheostomy, but also are ventilated with BiPAP, CPAP without a tracheostomy, and that might have a tracheostomy without ventilation. Also, home TPN, home IV fluids, home IV antibiotics, home IV potassium magnesium infusions, central line, PICC line, Hickman's line, and port management at home, cough assist management at home, nasogastric tube, PEG tube, patch tube management at home, as well as ventilator weaning at home and palliative care at home. We are employing hundreds of years of critical care nursing experience combined in the community. No other provider in Australia brings more nursing skills in the community than we do at intensive care at home. And, I've yet to see another provider that brings more expertise, intellectual property, and nursing skills in the community than we do at intensive care at home. We are currently operating all around Australia, in all major capital cities, as well as in all regional and rural areas. We are working with NDIS participants all around the country, TAC in Victoria, WorkSafe in Victoria, as well as the DVA all around the country. Our clients, and we as a provider, we have also received funding through departments of health, private and public hospitals. So, you know, that's all available for clients as well. We're also providing NDIS support coordination for our clients. So if you need an NDIS support coordinator, please reach out to us at intensivecareathome.com as well. So I also want to welcome our viewers on replay. For those of you watching this on replay, and whether you're watching this live or on replay, if you like what I'm doing here, give the video a like, subscribe to my YouTube channel for regular updates for families in intensive care and intensive care at home. Share the video with anyone who will benefit from this video and click the notification bell and leave your comments or ask your questions so I know what content to create. Usually I go for about an hour. So I'll be wrapping this up in about 55 minutes. So this is your opportunity to talk to me, ask your questions. You can also talk to me live on the StreamYard link here. But without further ado, George Webb has sent a question. He says, in ICU on a feeding tube and breathing machine for 6 days, remove the life support and move to comfort care, question mark. Nothing but morphine given. I guess they die from starvation, right? Great question, George, and thank you for sharing this. And before I answer the question, of course, you know, I need to make a comment that I've made many times since I've been doing my blog. The biggest challenge for families in intensive care is simply that they don't know what they don't know. They don't know what to look for. They don't know what questions to ask. They don't know their rights, and they don't know how to manage doctors and nurses in intensive care. And your question here, George, shines all of that through. You know, but I will break this down for you because you, unfortunately, you're getting so many things wrong here on so many levels. And this is not your fault. You know, this is ICU team's fault. This is how ICU is running with families. You know, they always want to keep the upper end. They always want to stay in control who lives and dies. And that's clearly shining through in George's question here. So let's break this down. Your loved one is in ICU on a feeding tube and breathing machine for 6 days. So number one, why? Why is your loved one on a breathing tube and breathing machine and a feeding tube? Why? That's number one. Number two, 6 days in ICU is not a long time. Not a long time at all. Removing life support would be extremely premature. Would be extremely premature. You would regret that, right? So, for example, you have to project yourself 12 months out from today. Project yourself 12 months out from today, right? And make decisions around that. Do you think you might regret in 12 months' time if you withdraw treatment on your loved one today? Think about that. Think about that. I think you would. The next question you need to ask here, where's the urgency to kill your loved one? Where's the rush? Where's the urgency to kill someone? Right? Where's the rush to move someone to comfort care and let them die? Now, you're saying nothing but morphine has been given. I challenge that. I argue that if your loved one is on a breathing tube, they're usually also given morphine or probably midazolam or propofol or potentially Presidex. The only reason they may not have any sedatives is if they have a significant brain injury and they are a Glasgow Coma Scale of 3, but that might also mean they're brain dead. You haven't mentioned anything here about that. And you're saying, I guess they die from starvation, right? No, wrong. No. So you're talking about your loved one having a feeding tube. Now, I can almost guarantee your loved one is getting nasogastric tube feeds, or if they can't tolerate nasogastric tube feeds, they should have TPN, also known as IV nutrition. Again, George, the biggest challenge for families in intensive care is simply that they don't know what they don't know. They don't know what to look for. They don't know what questions to ask. They don't know their rights, and they don't know how to manage doctors and nurses in intensive care. You see, what we do here at intensivecarehotline.com is making sure that families improve their life instantly. Families have peace of mind, control, power, and influence so that they can influence decision-making fast, even if they're not doctors or nurses in intensive care. Making sure their loved ones always, always, always get best care and treatment. And with what you're sharing with me here, the ICU team is trying to sell you on an end-of-life decision so they can free up their bed, they can save money, out of sight, out of mind. Now, like I said, you haven't really shared why your loved one is in ICU. Would be very valuable to know why your loved one is in ICU, because you're absolutely right to be concerned. And sadly, what you're describing is something we see all too often in intensive care units all around the world. And let me say this clearly, just like I said on my blog at intensivecarehotline.com every day, withdrawing life support and moving to quote unquote comfort care, which is a euphemism for killing your loved one, usually means stopping life-saving treatment, including stopping the ventilator, breathing machine, stopping artificial nutrition and hydration, which is given through the feeding tube, and giving medications like morphine instead. Now, that could also be perceived as euthanasia. Look up the definition of euthanasia. Euthanasia is, number one, it's illegal. Number two, the definition of euthanasia is hastening death. Now, if someone is getting morphine in large quantities, that's hastening death, right? The devil is in the detail. And what you see is often not what you get when you have a family member in intensive care. If you don't ask the right question, if you're like 99% of families in intensive care, you just get walked all over and you don't have peace of mind. You don't have control. You don't have power. You don't have influence, let alone can you influence decision making, and let alone will you make informed decisions. And yes, if artificial nutrition and hydration are stopped and the only thing that's given is morphine, death often occurs from starvation and dehydration, right? But again, that would also be coming under the umbrella of euthanasia, I believe, because that would also hasten death. Food and nutrition is a basic human right, and that doesn't stop in intensive care. Now, ICUs are often trying to undermine those basic human rights if you don't ask the right questions. You know, if families in intensive care think, oh, ICUs then must know what they're doing. Yeah, they do know what they're doing to empty their beds often. Now, disclaimer here, I will say this, having worked in the industry for a long time, there's a lot of good things happening in ICU. A lot of good things happening. There's way more good things happening in ICU than bad things. By the same token, the people that come to us here, you know, it's sort of the 10% of patients in ICU where things are not going great. Another thing you need to know here, George, is roughly 70 to 90% of intensive care patients survive. There's enough research out there to show the statistics, right? Again, intensive care teams are not telling you that. They just want to tell you what they want you to hear. Because if you think about that, 70 to 90% of intensive care patients survive, you would also know that the odds are in your loved one's favor. So your comment is coming from an uninformed point or from an uninformed perspective, right? The other thing that intensive care, working in intensive care has taught me is patients are extremely resilient, which again shows in the survival rate. But ICU teams are only giving you the doom and gloom, and they only want to make it look like, oh, your loved one won't survive, so that they can stay in control of, number one, the narrative, the meaning, and number three, of who lives and dies. It's much easier for them to say, oh, your loved one's going to die. And then your loved one is improving. And then, you know, everyone's clapping their hands and say, oh, you know, great that your loved one's getting better. But if your loved one isn't getting better and is going to die, they've protected their downside and they can say to you, well, I've told you so. Right? If they were to overpromise and underdeliver, you could hold them accountable. So you have to read between the lines, folks, right? Don't go into intensive care blindly, like 99% of families do go. And yes, to educate you on this in that much depth has taken me decades. You know, like I said, I've worked in critical care nursing for over 25 years. So, you know, I've seen the good, the bad, the ugly. I've seen the manipulation. I've seen all the good things. I've seen all the heroic measures that have been taken place. But I've also seen the not so heroic side of intensive care, which is to withdraw life support prematurely and sometimes without patient or family consent, you know, which could be perceived as murder, euthanasia, whatever you want to call it. So to break this down further, George, if artificial nutrition and hydration are stopped and the only thing that's given is morphine, death often occurs from starvation and dehydration, masked by sedation and painkillers. That's a slow process, and many families in intensive care are not told the full truth about what comfort care really means. Again, comfort care is a euphemism for end-of-life care. So here's what you need to know. What does comfort care really mean in ICU? Comfort care sounds compassionate, but in practice, it's often cruel, and it means stopping the ventilator, leading to death from respiratory failure if the patient can't breathe on their own, stopping nutrition, like with the feeding tube, stopping hydration, IV fluids or through the feeding tube, only giving sedatives or opiates like morphine or midazolam or propofol, which suppresses the respiratory drive even further. And that, once again, in my eyes, is euthanasia. And euthanasia is illegal. So, though patients do not die from starvation, they would die from starvation if you don't give them food for many days, if you don't give them hydration for many days. But it doesn't necessarily happen straight away, right? You don't need to stop feeds or hydration if you're giving morphine, midazolam, and propofol, and you stop the breathing machine. Patients will inevitably die, right? So here's what the right questions to ask are, George. Instead of you talking about removing life support and moving to comfort care, the better question to ask here is, what are they doing to save your loved one's life? What are they doing to help your loved one recover? Have you asked that question? If so, why not? If you haven't asked that question, you are completely under the spell of the ICU narrative. It's about asking the right question and ask the right questions. So what would happen if life support is removed? If your loved one can't breathe without the ventilator, they may pass away very quickly from a respiratory arrest, especially if they're given morphine. If they could breathe, but they aren't given food or water, it may take days to weeks for them to die from starvation and dehydration. But again, picture this. That could be perceived as murder. Definitely as euthanasia. So why would you even engage? I can't believe how easy it is to manipulate families in intensive care into horrible things. You know, also there's plenty of research out there that suggests that early feeding in ICU helps with recovery. So, you know, have you asked them, are they feeding? Why are they not feeding? You know, like, they have a duty to feed. Right? ICU teams are very good at pretending they can do whatever they want. Well, until you challenge them. You know, you just got to challenge them. It all comes down to that. So, morphine is used to reduce any symptoms, but also lowers the respiratory rate, which will hasten death. Inevitably will hasten death. So yes, in many cases, this is a form of euthanasia, and families are not always told that clearly. So, what should you ask the ICU team? Number one, what are they doing to help your loved one survive, to help them improve, to help them help to get them out of ICU alive? That is your very first question. I would have preferred you asking me that question Because that's telling me you're under the spell of the ICU team, and it's telling me you are buying into the narrative from the intensive care team instead of creating your own narrative. The families in intensive care that are determined to create their own narrative are winning. Families who don't create their own narrative and buy into the intensive care team's narrative are not winning. So, what should you ask the intensive care team? Number one, what are they doing to help your loved one survive? Have all treatment options been exhausted? Have they looked at all treatment options? Have they educated you about all treatment options? Have you educated yourself about all treatment options? What would be the clinical and also moral and ethical justification for stopping treatment? Have you asked that question? Do they need the ICU bed? Are they worried they're not making any money on your family member? Next, has there been enough time to assess recovery potential? Can your loved one breathe on their own? Are they still conscious or responsive in any way? What happens if they stop the morphine? What are the alternatives to stopping treatment, like rehab, tracheostomy, PEG tube feeding, step down, ICU care, intensive care at home, and you can find more information at intensivecareathome.com. And why are they potentially pressuring you to make such a rush decision? And like I said earlier, where's the urgency to kill your loved one? Have you asked them? Have you asked them that question? Where's the rush? Where's the urgency to kill your family member? Ask them that question and see what they say. Is there an advanced care directive from your family member? So has your family member written down something, what they want in a situation like that? So never let ICU teams bully or guilt trip you into a decision you're not ready to make. 6 days on life support in ICU is not a long time, and it's certainly not enough time in most cases to determine a long-term prognosis. Right? ICU wants to make you believe 6 days in ICU is a long time. 6 weeks in ICU may not be a long time. 6 months in ICU may not be a long time, depending on the situation. So you have to ask the right questions. Another very important point that I want to make here, George, is you have to find out whether it's a real or a perceived end-of-life situation. So what do I mean by that? A real end-of-life situation is your loved one's going to die no matter what. No matter what treatment the intensive care team is offering, what, you know, different medications, different treatment, surgery, life-saving, no matter what they offer, your loved one's going to die. That's a real end-of-life situation. But your loved one might be in a perceived end-of-life situation. So what's a perceived end-of-life situation? Well, I'm glad you've asked. Perceived end-of-life situation is that there's a perception that your loved one may die. But your loved one may actually survive. Isn't that a much better question to ask? Why don't you ask that question to the intensive care team? Right? So the bottom line is that 6 days in ICU on life support is not enough time in many cases to determine prognosis. We've helped thousands of families in intensive care to get their loved ones tracheostomy, PEG tubes, transfer to rehab, transfer to intensive care at home. They've improved, they've recovered. You know, we've also helped thousands of hundreds of families to avoid PEG tubes, you know, because of our industry insights and because of understanding intensive care inside out. And if you want a second opinion or someone to speak directly with the doctors with you, you know, you can reach out to me at intensivecarehotline.com and you will see that the dynamics will change in your favor very quickly. Or, you know, we look at medical records, we review medical records, we have a team that reviews medical records, and we will give you real-time information about what's really going on. And we give you real-time information in how that compares to what intensive care teams are actually telling you. You know, because withdrawing life support and providing only morphine while withholding food and fluids is euthanasia and most of the time results in death from starvation and dehydration disguised under the label of comfort care. So you are absolutely right to question it. Don't let them sugarcoat it at all. You know, don't let them sugarcoat that they're about to kill your loved one. Do not do that. Okay. Let's go to the next question that's come in during the week. What questions should you ask the ICU team when advocating for a tracheostomy for your loved one with a breathing tube? So, I want to talk about the topic of that comes up all the time for families in ICU. What questions should you ask the ICU team when advocating for a tracheostomy for your loved one who's on a breathing tube, also known as an endotracheal tube? Now, if your loved one has been in ICU for more than 7 to 10 days and is still on a ventilator with a breathing tube, and you're probably being told that your options are limited. You might be hearing things like, they're not waking up, they'll never come off the ventilator, there's no quality of life, or even worse, we should consider comfort care or withdrawal of treatment. But that's not the full picture, and that's why I'm here to give you real advocacy tools. The kind of questions you need to ask now to stop the ICU team from giving up too soon and to give your loved one the time and treatment they need and deserve. Let's get into it. Number one, ask them, why is your loved one still on the breathing tube? Start here. You need to find out the real reasons why they haven't been extubated. Is it a respiratory issue? Is there a neurological delay? Is sedation still running? Are they potentially not strong enough to come off the ventilator? And is that the reason why you think a tracheostomy is not the right thing to do? The ICU team must tell you clearly why your loved one can't come off the ventilator. But even if they're not strong enough and can't come off the ventilator, that's exactly when intensive care at home comes in. You know, get patients in ICU tracheostomy, and if they can't be weaned, take them home with intensive care at home. Next, ask, what's the plan if your loved one can't be extubated in the next few days? This is a critical question. If ICU doesn't have a plan, you need to create one with them. And that plan should include tracheostomy if your loved one is medically stable, avoiding a one-way extubation if there's a risk of failure, stopping sedation to assess neurological function properly. And again, once a tracheostomy is done and your loved one potentially can't come off the ventilator, look at an option such as intensive care at home. So, also, what's a one-way extubation? In case you wonder, what ICUs are often trying to do if they think a patient shouldn't have a tracheostomy. They want to move a patient to a one-way extubation. That's basically a death sentence. Basically means they're taking patients off the ventilator and, you know, letting them die. Don't let that happen. Now you know what options are there. Next, is my loved one ready for a tracheostomy? If your loved one's not progressing, a tracheostomy may be the best chance for them to come off sedation. Again, ICU teams are not telling you that when the tracheostomy is done, or one of the goals of the tracheostomy is to stop sedation, stop opiates, so that your loved one can wake up properly, start physical therapy, breathe more comfortably, and get out of bed, get mobilized. If the ICU team says no to that, ask them why not. What's stopping them? Is it medical or is it hospital policy? Right? Is it just complacency of them not wanting to do a tracheostomy and then have your loved one in ICU for potentially days, weeks, months to come. You have to ask those questions. So what are the benefits of a tracheostomy in a situation like this? So let the team explain to you, does it reduce sedative needs or sedation needs or opiate needs? Can it help with weaning off the ventilator? Does it allow for more patient comfort and mobility? And mobility is a big one. Make them justify their decisions either way. This is your loved one's life on the line, not theirs. Also, when you look at patients on sedation and opiates in ICU, keep in mind that those are the very medications that inhibit spontaneous breathing drive. So the minute you stop sedation and opiates, you know, your loved one should breathe up more. Now, there's many factors to consider here. For example, you know, just because you stop sedation and opiates and your loved one can breathe, for example, if they're too weak or if they're in too much pain, you have to resedate them and you have to gradually build them up towards a tracheostomy or extubation, whatever the case may be. But for ICU teams to blatantly say, we can't do a tracheostomy, that's just a whole lot of nonsense. Next, what are the risks of keeping the breathing tube in longer? They need to tell you all about the damage to vocal cords or the trachea. Increased risk of ventilator-associated pneumonia. Discomfort and the inability to wean. A tracheostomy is often less invasive long-term than keeping someone on a breathing tube indefinitely. You can keep someone on a tracheostomy indefinitely, but you can't keep someone on a breathing tube indefinitely. Right? And there's also a risk for a ventilator-associated pneumonia with a tracheostomy, but it's usually lower compared to a breathing tube. Right? Also, ask them, what are your loved one's arterial blood gases? What do chest x-rays look like? Are there any other contraindications that prohibit a tracheostomy, such as high PEEP, high pressure support, high FiO2? You know, those are real contraindications. But if those contraindications are not there, then it might simply be that the ICU team wants to push the narrative of end-of-life care without giving you the full spectrum of why a tracheostomy will probably help. Next, are you recommending a tracheostomy or just pushing for withdrawal of treatment? This is where you separate ICU treatment from the ICU agenda. Too often, once day 10 or day 14 hits on a ventilator with a breathing tube, ICU teams are starting to push families towards end-of-life care, especially if they think the patient won't recover quickly. You must ask, is the tracheostomy being considered seriously? Are you recommending it medically or discouraging it because of policy, staffing, finances, or bed management? Right? The sooner you can actually question their agenda, the better. Assuming things are not going great, if things are going great, give them applause. No question. Nothing wrong with doing good things. Give them applause if they're doing good things. If they're doing bad things, don't give them applause and question. So, next, what happens after a tracheostomy? Well, ask for the full plan. Will they go to a step-down ICU, HDU, progressive care, or home with a ventilator with intensive care at home? And again, you can find more information at intensivecareathome.com. Will they be able to eat, talk, and do rehabilitation and get mobilized? You must know what comes next so you can prepare and make informed decisions, have peace of mind, control, power, and influence. Right? Because they are all really important questions to ask. So, can you stop sedation so we can see if your loved one wakes up? This is absolutely critical. Sedation and opiates often masks your loved one's ability to breathe, respond, recover, wake up. ICU teams will say things like they're not waking up, but they've been sedated for 2 weeks. Of course they're not waking up. Right? Ask, when will they stop sedation? When will you do a neurological assessment of sedation? Only then can you truly know if a tracheostomy will help move things forward. Right? So for example, once sedation is off and your loved one is not waking up, God forbid, have they had a stroke? Have they had a neurological event? Do they need a neurological consult, CT scan of the brain, MRI scan of the brain, EEGs, you know, just to name a few, right? And just once again, I can't stress enough that with sedatives and opiates on board, again, sedatives are midazolam, Verset, propofol, Presidex predominantly. Opiates are morphine, fentanyl, oxycodone, OxyContin predominantly. Those medications all have as a side effect respiratory depression, i.e. your loved one won't breathe up. So for ICU teams to say they will never wake up and they will never breathe is nonsense whilst they are sedated. Right? Once again, you need to read between the lines and you need to make sure you understand all the intricacies of intensive care. The devil is in the detail. Next, is the ICU team's decision based on patient needs or hospital's limitations? Let's be real. ICUs often operate under pressure, limited beds, limited staff, policy timelines, limited finances, but those should not override your loved one's right to live and have a fair chance at recovery. Right? Keep that in mind, your loved one's right to live. It's not the ICU team's decision to let your loved one die. Right? Once again, like I said earlier, ask them, where's the urgency and the rush to kill your loved one? Next question you should be asking, can we revisit this every 24 to 48 hours? Because things change quickly in ICU. If the answer today is no tracheostomy, it might be yes in 48 hours. Ask the team for daily updates. Keep the pressure on. In summary, a tracheostomy can be a turning point in your loved one's recovery. But if you don't ask the right questions, you may never be given that option. Or worse, you might be pressured into giving up too soon. So, you know, we've helped so many clients in intensive care over the years to either advocate for a tracheostomy or, on the other hand, avoid a tracheostomy and have the breathing tube removed. You know, again, either direction has its time and its place. If you understand intensive care inside out, like I do, like me and my team do, right? So, let's look at other questions that have come in during the week, or if you do have any questions, please let me know. Whilst I'm looking at other questions that have come in. Now, where are we? So, another question that has come in this week was actually from Akim, who says, "Hi Patrick, my mom has been in ICU for 2 weeks. She accidentally took too much insulin, which resulted into hypoglycemia, which means low blood sugars. And now she's on a ventilator. The doctors have said since she's unresponsive, we have a week to decide if we want to do long-term care, tracheostomy feeding tube, or call hospice." I find it interesting that just because a doctor in ICU tells you you have a week to decide, you just take it for face value. I cannot believe how easily intimidated families in intensive care are. If the doctor told you to jump off a bridge, would you jump off a bridge? If the answer is no, why would you let them dictate you by when you have to make a decision? Think about that. You are too easily influenced. You are too easily coerced, really. That's what it is. Don't do that. Don't do that. Might be easier said than done. For me, I've always struggled with authority. I have always challenged authority. And if you're not sort of skilled at challenging authority, you need to get skilled at challenging authority in intensive care, or you need to find someone like myself who's used to challenging authority all the time. Right? So let's look at another question from Akim, who says, who says, "Hi Patrick, my mom has been in ICU for 2 weeks. She accidentally took too much insulin, which resulted into hypoglycemia, which is low blood sugar. And she's now on a ventilator with a breathing tube. The ICU doctors have said, since she's unresponsive, we have 1 week to decide if we want to do long-term care, tracheostomy, feeding tube, or call hospice and let her die. Once again, the first thing you need to do is question everything they say. And if they're telling you you have 1 week to decide, I would tell them, and who are you to tell me how long I have to decide? That would be my response. Since when do you let people tell you what to do when it comes to life or death? Right? Think about it. But thanks for sharing anyway, Akin. I am very sorry to hear what you and your family are going through, because based on what you've shared, your mom is unresponsive in ICU after a hypoglycemic event caused by too much insulin. She's been on a ventilator for 2 weeks, and now the ICU team is pressuring you to decide between a tracheostomy and PEG feeding tube for long-term care or moving her to hospice. Here's what you need to know, and what I'd be saying if this was a call between you and me and the doctors in intensive care. So, if ICU doctors say your mom is unresponsive, do not let that be the end of the conversation. If your mom is in ICU on a ventilator for 2 weeks due to a hypoglycemic coma, and they're telling you she's unresponsive, you need to ask a lot more questions before agreeing to hospice or a tracheostomy. Too often, ICU teams are pushing families into life-ending decisions like hospice far too early, without families having asked the right questions, or without families having even been given the opportunity to ask the right questions. They only usually find out when they talk to me or to my team that they've been given the short end of the stick. Especially when someone isn't, quote unquote, quickly waking up, and not as quickly waking up as they expect. But here's the truth. Recovery from hypoxic brain injuries or metabolic injuries like hypoglycemia can take weeks or months, not days. Right? Ask the following questions right now so that you get a better understanding. What exactly do they mean by your mom being unresponsive? Is she opening her eyes? Is she following commands? Is she reacting to pain or sound? What is her Glasgow Coma Scale, also known as GCS score? Is she still sedated? Because if she's still sedated, your mom probably won't wake up, right? You have to ask the right questions. And if she is still sedated, why have they not stopped it? Is there an agenda to not let her wake up? Right? What is the CT or MRI scan or potentially EEG showing? Is there any brain swelling, hypoxic brain injury, or bleeding? Is an EEG showing seizure activity or suppressed brain function? Are her sugars stable now? What are her sedation levels? Has sedation been stopped long enough to assess her real neurological status? Have opiates been stopped for long enough to assess her real neurological status? Is this a hypoglycemia-related encephalopathy, or a global brain injury? And is there any hope for recovery based on that? Next, what's the rush to kill your loved one in ICU? Where's the rush? Where's the urgency? Where's the urgency to cure your mom? Where's the urgency to help your mom? Why is there no urgency for that? You should be asking that question. 2 weeks in ICU is not long enough time to determine recovery potential from a metabolic brain injury like this. Hypoglycemia can lead to brain dysfunction that sometimes does reverse, depending on how low her blood sugar was and for how long. We've seen patients wake up after 3 to 4 weeks or longer. If your mom has any signs of neurological activity, eye opening, movement, reacting to voice or pain, that is not the end of the road whatsoever. If she's stable and she's not waking up, after about 10 to 14 days, absolutely consider a tracheostomy, but not necessarily a PEG tube, you know. And a tracheostomy will definitely buy her time. A tracheostomy is a much safer, more comfortable long-term airway than a breathing tube through the mouth. She won't need a PEG tube right now. A PEG tube is only needed if someone cannot come off the ventilator beyond the shadow of a doubt. And that is not the case in your mom's situation. Nutrition can be provided safely through a nasogastric tube. No PEG tube is needed for now. These interventions, like a nasogastric feeding tube and a tracheostomy, would buy your mom valuable time. You know, they are just stepping stones to give your mom's body time to rest and heal, and for you to assess recovery over a longer period of time. And be extremely wary of hospice pressure. Hospice means no more active treatment. Hospice means a death sentence. Hospice means end of life care. If your mom is not brain dead and still has vital signs, this may be absolutely premature and irreversible. Once hospice is started, things like fluids, nutrition, and antibiotics are often getting withdrawn. In essence, it would be life support withdrawal under the label of comfort care. It's a euphemism for a death sentence. Ask them directly. If we choose hospice, will she still get nutrition, fluids, antibiotics, and will her basic care needs be met? And the answer to most of those questions would be a no. I can tell you that from all my experience. Now, final word here. Don't let ICU teams corner you into a rushed decision. The brain and body needs time, especially after a metabolic crisis like hypoglycemia. You're not obligated to choose between tracheostomy or hospice in just a week. And again, I'm very confident that we can around we have done with so many other times. Right? So we've done it all. But you know, need to be and need to know. How to deal with intensive care teams, how to manage them. Right? If you don't know that, you'll be fighting an uphill battle. But you also need to take responsibility, right? If you don't take responsibility when your loved one is critically ill in intensive care, if you don't take responsibility for the outcomes, I can assure you the ICU team will take responsibility for the outcome, and that is often death. Don't let that be you. Don't let that be you. You can't afford to let that be you. Right? So just be very mindful here once again. So, final words, like I've got another 10 minutes to go, 10 minutes left roughly. Just a few words to intensive care at home participants and clients as well. Just in recent weeks, we've been dealing again with NDIS participants, and we've also had another major win in terms of having a doctor review for one of our ventilated NDIS participants in the community who's ventilated with a tracheostomy, has got cerebral palsy as an underlying disability. And the NDIS, as we all know, wants to push support worker models onto ventilated and tracheostomy clients, which are basically intensive care patients, and obviously we have become very good over the years now to provide the evidence for our clients, for our intensive care at home clients, for the NDIS, making sure they get intensive care nurses and not support workers, because not even general registered nurses can look after ventilated patients, whether it's in ICU or in the community, right? So for the NDIS to push support worker models onto ventilated clients, it's just negligent, and people have died because of it, And if anyone wants to reach out, I can provide the evidence for that, And so coming back to our ventilated client, because the case has gone to the Administrative Rights Tribunal at the NDIS, and there's an independent doctor assessment also confirming that, a ventilated patient in the community needs critical care nurses, not support workers. Also, it's not only that doctors, nurses, anyone worth their salt in the industry, will say, of course, it has to be a critical care nurse. But there's also evidence, not only from doctors, nurses, but there's also evidence-based research. Have a look at our website at intensivecareathome.com. There's a section, the mechanical home ventilation guidelines, and those guidelines clearly say that only critical care nurses with 2 years minimum ICU experience can safely look after ventilated patients with tracheostomies in a home care environment. That includes patients on BiPAP without tracheostomy, and that includes patients with a tracheostomy without BiPAP. So anyone who recommends a support worker model is putting patients' lives at risk. And maybe the NDIS just wants to save money by letting those people die, like so many others have died over the years, where the NDIS is pushing for a support worker model. Right? So another win there for our clients, and that's really fantastic. And it also, there's some wonderful things about the NDIS, and the longer NDIS goes on, I think more healthcare professionals wake up, especially the ones worth their salt. And they realize that we cannot let this happen as healthcare professionals, whether it's doctors, nurses, physios, OTs, we cannot let this happen to have support workers look after critical care patients in the community. What happens next? Have support workers in ICU in a hospital? Is that what's going to happen next? The NDIS sometimes wants to treat their participants as second-class citizens. Because the minute those participants go back to hospital, they will have critical care nurses. Right? So I can see that there's more people coming on now. If you have any questions, please type them into the chat pad or connect with me on StreamYard directly here. Also, if you're watching this and you are a critical care nurse in Australia, we've got jobs currently for critical care nurses in the community in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, in Albury, Wodonga, in Warragul in Victoria, in Bendigo in Victoria, in Geelong, also in Wielangta, which is in country Victoria. So we have a variety of jobs going at the moment. If you are interested and you are a critical care nurse with a minimum of 2 years critical care nursing experience, please reach out to us. We're also expanding our medical team if you're an intensive care specialist and you want to expand your experience into the community. I encourage you to reach out to us at intensivecareathome.com. We're also expanding our medical team at intensivecarehotline.com. If you're in the US watching this and you want to work with us, especially if you're an intensive care specialist and you want to help us advocate for our clients, for our US audience, we want to hear from you as well. So, yeah. Please type your questions into the chat pad. We've got another 5 minutes left. Or connect with me live on the StreamYard link here. If not, I'll just keep talking about the advocacy that we're doing for our clients with intensive care at home in particular. You know, nursing assessments are needed, OT assessments, physio assessments, but also sometimes speech therapy. It's all needed for NDIS in particular, but also for other funding bodies such as the TAC, you know, iCare, also for DVA or for Queensland motor insurance for people in Queensland that have been in car accidents, you know, that have catastrophic injuries. You know, that's all the evidence that is often needed. We're also providing level 2 NDIS support coordination for our NDIS participants. So please reach out to us as well if you're looking for an NDIS support coordinator, right? So for anyone that hasn't, hasn't had the opportunity to ask a question today, please email us at support@intensivecarehotline.com or info@intensivecareathome.com. Or you can just call us on one of the numbers on the top of our website at intensivecarehotline.com or intensivecareathome.com. We also have a membership for families of critically ill patients in intensive care, and you can join the membership if you go to intensivecarehotline.com, if you click on the membership link, or if you go to intensivecaresupport.org directly. In the membership, you have access to me and my team 24 hours a day in the membership area and via email, and we answer all questions intensive care related. In the membership, you also have exclusive access to 21 ebooks and 21 videos that are only exclusively accessible for our members. And all of that will help you to make informed decisions, have peace of mind, control, power, and influence, making sure your loved one gets best care and treatment always. And do never, ever negotiate on your loved one getting best care and treatment. Never, ever. Irregardless of what intensive care teams are telling you, to never ever negotiate on that and create your own narrative. Don't let anybody create their narrative without you doing your research. Okay. So I'm going to wrap this up for today here. Thank you so much for watching. Thank you for joining. If you like the work that I'm doing here, like the video, subscribe to my YouTube channel, share the video with your friends and families, and leave your comments so I know. Leave your comments, leave your questions so I know what content you want me to create. And do you agree with the things that I'm saying? Do you not agree? You know, I welcome any opinions to have a lively discussion. So thank you so much for watching. I will join you again next week at the same time and look out for my videos that I'll be publishing during the week. Take care for now.